begin by thanking the Eminofer Fellowship, the program, and PI for this really wonderful opportunity to spend several months here at the Institute. It's been wonderful. PI is an amazing place, very vibrant, engaging. It's been a really special experience. So let me see if I can get this back on.
Just go to sleep. Or...
Yeah, I hope. Okay, there you go. So Rob asked me to give an overview of the causal set approach to quantum gravity. And some of you are very familiar with this approach and perhaps have listened to too many introductory talks on causal sets. But I think that it's an approach that is out of the mainstream by and large, so I think it would be useful for the larger community to know what this particular approach to quantum gravity is all about. So here's the outline for my talk. I'll begin with a sort of a historic foray into an attempt to understand Lorentzian geometry from a rather different perspective. And this goes back to Penrose, Kronheimer, and others, Hawking, Malament, a list of people from the 60s into the 70s, trying to understand what makes Lorentzian geometry different, what makes it distinct. Okay, so I'll give you a little overview of that. And this is really the motivation for the causal set approach, forms a main motivation, if you like, to the causal set approach. And then I will describe how we can try to get geometry from the order theoretic structure and the different routes to dynamics. Most of the talk will just be an exposition on the broad, you know, broad strokes describing the theory. I will not spend any time on the phenomenology, but this is a very compelling part of the causal set approach. But since I don't work in this area and there's not enough time to really go into this, we have predictions for the cosmological constant coming from causal set theory. There's also a very interesting non-locality experiments. I will not spend any time on this, but it is a very important part of the causal set approach. And then I'll end with some directions and challenges. And here are my various collaborators, people I've worked with in the past and continue to work with. So before I begin, I'm going to borrow an idea of Raphael Sorkin's, which is put out in this paper of his in 1997 called Forks on the Road on the Way to Quantizing Gravity. And the idea is that when you're on this route to quantum gravity, we think of that as a route, but there are certain points at which we have to make decisions about where to go. So I'm going to borrow that idea and use it to give you a cartoon, write down this very crude cartoon. And I'm actually going to follow a particular path today, going from Lorentzian to path integral to discrete, and that'll lead us to this approach, this causal set approach. And of course, different paths lead us elsewhere to the various different approaches to quantum gravity. Perhaps all of us are equally far away, infinitely far away from this pot of gold here. The important thing and why this is a fork rather than simply a route which you can go back on, if you like, or sort of connect it up in different ways, is that that's true in different parts of physics. For example, if I did quantum field theory on a fixed background, then I can switch between the Euclidean and Lorentzian picture just by a weak rotation, and one does that all the time. The Hamiltonian and path integral, you can switch between these two as well. And these are not choices you have to make. You actually find that these approaches are all equivalent. However, it seems from one's experience in quantum gravity that these are in fact actual forks. There's no going back. Okay, well, you could go back and do something else, but you can't, it's really a tree. You can't go back via Lorentzian geometry to Euclidean geometry and so on and so forth. So I'll use this analogy through the talk to sort of motivate the various directions one takes and motivate the various decisions one takes at each fork. So the first fork that we want to take is that of Lorentzian geometry. And you can ask, well, what is the essence of Lorentzian geometry? I mean, are we to think of it as a mere generalization of Riemannian geometry? And for a very long time, this is how people thought of it. Sorry, I'm a bit. They thought of it as just a pseudo-Riemannian geometry. Just take regular Riemannian geometry, add a minus sign to it, and there you go, you have pseudo-Riemannian geometry. And there's nothing different about it. We think of topology, differentiable structure, everything in the same way that we think about Riemannian geometry. So you build topology out of open balls. Those open balls are, of course, things that you would imagine as sort of neighborhoods in a Riemannian space where distance is defined positive distance function. And so you define topology, differentiable structure, in the same way that you do for Riemannian geometry. So everything is just borrowed from Riemannian geometry. But is it essentially different? Is Lorentzian geometry essentially different? And the answer, of course, is yes, because if I look at the line element, I know that distances squared can be positive, negative, or zero, and that gives rise to light cones, which are absolutely absent in Riemannian geometry. These light cones allow you to distinguish between null, this red line, the green is a space-like direction, and time-like directions. And in particular, the time-like direction has a future as well as a past. They're two different time-like directions. This light cone structure is absent in Riemannian geometry. That's very, you know, special to the Lorentzian geometry. In fact, you can think of this essential relation, which is the causality relation defined between the events in the space-time, x and y. You say that they're causally related if there exists a causal curve between x and y, from x to y. And this ordering relation is what's going to be the heart of the story today. And this understanding of this local causality, I call it local causality because I'm just focusing on a small region of the space-time, is exactly what people started to think may in fact be what's at the heart of Lorentzian geometry. And there was a huge amount of effort, like I said, in the 60s, the 70s, to try to axiomatize Lorentzian geometry in a totally different way than one did earlier with Riemannian geometry. So in fact, what's interesting, if you look at this paper of Penrose and Kronheimer in 1966, they defined something called a causal space. And the attempt was to try to do precisely this, extract an essence. And they define the causal space X just as a set. Remember, when we think of manifolds, we think of them as coming with a lot of structure on them. We think of them coming with a topology, differentiable structure, all of that. This is simply a set, and we have these relations, the causal relation, the chronological relation, and the horismos, which is basically the null relation. And the axioms of a causal space are simply that they have to satisfy these various conditions. These first three conditions, in fact, are what make it into a partially ordered set. This first two, just X and the causal relation, become a partially ordered set, and I'll just explain that in a second. The others are sort of derivative, mixed transitivity conditions, and so on. And what I found interesting when I was reading this paper again, which I was fairly familiar with, is that they talk about trying to get out something like this, this essence, this causal space, to admit structures which can be, in fact, very different from a manifold. These ideas seem to be fairly old, that to look at Lorentzian geometry again, extract out this other underlying structure in order that one can think of space-time in a broader sense without giving up the concept of it being Lorentzian. Okay. So let's just focus on those first three properties. Like I said, that's what makes it into a poset, and this is what I will call from now on the causal structure poset. Which I denote by M, this preceding relation. And this M that I have here is simply the set. You have to shake this manifold loose of everything else. All that remain are the events, okay? So we don't think of it as a manifold anymore. You just think of it as a set. Shake it loose of all other structure. And this precedence relation is reflexive. So that's, in some sense, a choice of choice that you can make. You could either make it reflexive or irreflexive. But let's keep it reflexive right now. X precedes itself, so it's in its own future. It's acyclic, which means that if X precedes Y and Y precedes X, then these two points are the same. In other words, we don't have closed causal curves. And the third condition is that of transitivity, which means that if X precedes Y and Y precedes Z, then X precedes Z. And this is, of course, very obvious when you draw light cones, because we know that light cones come nested one inside the other. But transitivity is an important property of the causal structure. Now, let's ask the question. We know that Riemannian geometry doesn't have a causal structure. There are no light cones. But let's ask the question, well, let's try to look at other kinds of spacetimes, other kinds of spaces which are neither Lorentzian nor Riemannian, which means that we introduce other signatures. So here's an example of a minus, minus, plus, plus signature. And you say, well, is there a causal structure poset for such a spacetime? For such a, I don't even want to call it a spacetime, but for such a generalized spacetime. And if you think about it, because of the T1 and T2 directions, there are two time directions here. I have drawn them as well as best as I can. You have to think of the two spatial directions. I've collapsed them into one direction. But as you can see, the two time-like directions, they speak to each other, and they're forming a plane. Okay, they're forming an entire plane. And this means that you don't have anything like a future or past. The light cone is there. There is a light cone. I mean, it's a light structure, I should say. And there are null directions like this. But there's no future and past. What happens in such signature spacetimes is that time is connected. It is not disconnected. So the future and the past are not disconnected from each other. And so what you realize is that there is, for any other signature spacetime, there is no causal structure poset. So this causal structure poset that we've extracted out looks very obvious, is actually a signature of the spacetime being Lorentzian. It's a very, very special feature. It's absent in all other kinds of spaces.
Sorry, can I make a remark? As somebody who has promoted the two-time idea, you are making much too general statements here. If you look at my work, there is a way in which everything is causal, provided you put appropriate gauge constraints.
So I'm talking only about the... So maybe there's ways to recover causality and so on, but I'm just talking about the...
Maybe.
Oh, right. Right. Yeah.
I think a very general statement, which is much too general, which is not correct when it comes to the correct way of doing it.
So I accept that there could be more structures put on this, but what I'm trying to point out here is simply that if I didn't put anything else on it, this structure by itself has no causal structure poset that underlies it. Maybe we can recover things using this in other ways, and as you said that you have done that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking purely as the geometry, what geometric information is here. But thanks for pointing that out. So the causal structure is a very rich object, and in fact, much of the work in the 60s, the 70s, and ongoing work has been to try to understand the hierarchy of causal structure. You have spacetimes that satisfy very stringent stringent conditions on the causal structure. And one of the most stringent ones is that of global hyperbolicity, which makes our spacetimes that we deal with in classical GR predictable. In other words, you can do an initial value formulation, you can predict what will happen later. But you can weaken causality conditions, and there's a whole hierarchy of these. One of these is strong causality, and what is interesting is that in this case, this there is a topology that you can construct, which is built up completely out of the causal structure, which is called the Alexandrov topology. It's actually built out of what some of you may be familiar with. These are causal diamonds. And if you build up the space-time topology out of those causal diamonds, and you recover the manifold topology. And you can weaken these all the way down to future and past distinguishable, which is basically telling you that two points are distinguished by their futures or their pasts, all the way down to having closed time-like closed causal curves, in which case you have no causal structure per set. But there's this entire hierarchy and an entire very, very rich structure and a rich study that can be done using the causal structure. So one of the things that people asked very early on was, how primitive is this causal structure? Okay, we've stripped it of everything. You've got this completely ordered theoretic object. Looks nothing like a manifold. It could have come from something else. How much information does it contain about the space-time? One thing that you notice is that if I did a conformal transformation, then I know immediately that the causal structure is invariant. Something that's time-like remains time-like, something that's space-like, etc. Okay, this is an obvious thing. You can just look at the metric, and this is the overall scaling will not change this property. Indeed, what Hawking, King, McCarthy, and Malamud found was that the causal structure per set determines the entire conformal class of the metric. It has a huge amount of information about the metric. It contains the entire conformal information. And in particular, this is how they stated this. This is sort of a paraphrasing of their statement of the theorem, which is that if you have a causal bijection, in other words, if you take two spacetimes and you made sure that under this map F, that the causal relations were preserved. So x1, y1, if they were related in the spacetime, they're mapped onto events which are related in the second spacetime, and vice versa, it's a bijection. Then this function is a smooth conformal isometry, and that really means that this function maps one metric onto the other via conformal transformation. Okay? And the original work dealt with manifolds of fixed dimensions. In fact, particularly just four, although it doesn't matter for any dimension higher than two. And we were able to show that, in fact, this causal bijection, if it exists, also determines the dimension of the spacetime. So Finkelstein, I think, was the first to write it this way. He said, causal structure is 9/10 of the spacetime geometry. If you think of the metric as in four dimensions as having 10 independent components, then it's 9/10 of the metric, because the only thing remaining is one scalar. Right? The conformal information is everything but the scalar information. So really what one is saying is one is breaking up space-time, the Lorentzian geometry, into this very different construction, which is the causal structure plus a volume. Okay? The causal structure is an extremely important essence. It is sort of the soul, if you like, of a Lorentzian manifold. So now you can ask the question, well, all right, there's causal structure, that's a poset. Where can this volume element come from? And for a very long time, people did have these ideas to take this causal structure and try to do something with it, try to construct a quantum theory. But then you have to have this extra ingredient, which is volume. And that's where the hypothesis of discreteness comes in. And this is something that one can motivate in several different ways. One is, you know, curing various kinds of infinities, quantum field theory divergences, regulating entanglement entropy, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at it from purely this geometric point of view, that you had this causal structure poset, and you said, well, can I try to somehow get volume just out of it without doing anything more? Okay? From the most minimalistic perspective possible. And the way to do that is to say, well, yes, let's go back to that causal structure post-set, but now let's impose another condition on it, which is that of local finiteness. And by that, I mean the following, that if I have two events, X and Y, which are related to each other, then I look at the causal diamond or the future of this intersecting the past of, that, yeah, the causal diamond, the interval, the space-time interval between them. And if it has a finite volume, then I say there's only a finite number of fundamental space-time events in here. So you make the assumption, the hypothesis of atomicity that space-time is fundamentally atomic. Okay? And what does that do for you? It tells you that if there's a correspondence between the volume and the number, then you recover volume information by just counting. Cardinality becomes that extra volume element that was missing. Okay? So by imposing local finiteness, the causal set or the causal structure poset is enriched also with this additional volume element. Okay? So here's a fork in the road that we make, which is the assumption of discreteness, purely from the idea of reconstructing space-time from the causal structure. And these ideas are not old. The idea that the causal structure can be used and the idea somehow to incorporate discreteness harks back to many, many ideas. And so this is sort of an attempt to summarize it, but I'll just leave it here for a few seconds for you to read. So what the causal set hypothesis does is to distill a lot of this and put it all together and add in a few important new ingredients. Some of these ideas, like I said, have been around. One very interesting preprint due to Mirheim had a lot of the ingredients that the paper that Bombelli, Lee, Meyer, and Sorkin finally wrote on formulating the causal set hypothesis. So there are two fundamental, so we've finally come down to what a causal set is. There are two fundamental building blocks. One is the causal structure poset, and the other is a fundamental space-time discreteness. And the hypothesis is that the underlying structure of space-time is a causal set or locally finite partially ordered set. Okay? What does a locally finite partially ordered set look like? It could look something like this. We want to replace space-time with objects that look like this. The continuum then arises not as a limit in the theory. It arises instead as an approximation because we really want to think of discreteness as fundamental. And it's very similar to how we think of solids and liquids. We think of the continuum, but underlying it is an atomic structure, molecular structure, discrete structure. And it's very similar to that. So the continuum arises as an approximation. And there's at any time, we have to keep in mind that there is a fundamental discrete structure. And this actually is a very important difference between other approaches where discreteness is used as a regulator, and you do everything to remove the regulator at the end. Discreteness here is fundamental, and we must understand things with that fundamental discreteness put in. So how does it arise as an approximation? We have space-time geometry, which is given by causal structure plus volume. This was the theorem from Lorentzian geometry. And we're replacing causal structure with a partially ordered set. And we've got space-time volume encoded in number. So here, this explains the title of my talk. And this is a slogan that Raphael Sorkin coined years ago, which is that order plus number gives you, in an approximate sense, space-time geometry. Okay. So there's a dilemma that Riemann had when he started to think about, very, very long ago, obviously, and this I've taken from Finkelstein's paper, which is that he felt convinced that discreteness was at the heart of thinking about space. And he had these two arguments why the world must be discrete. But then he also had this confusion because he said, we have continuous symmetries in our world, so the world must be continuous. Because a dilemma, how do we resolve these two? And that's a question we'd have to ask ourselves if we pick discreteness as a root, how do we recover continuous symmetries? Well, the answer surprisingly comes just from our number to volume correspondence, which we should take seriously because that's how we, that was sort of the basis of the foundations for the approach. And so you can say, well, let's try to construct from the continuum an underlying causal set. The simplest thing you could do is to construct a discrete lattice, a regular lattice like this. And here in two dimensions, I've constructed a light cone lattice, and all the intersection points are meant to be elements. I've picked out three of them because I've picked out one space-time region here, and I've said, well, let's look at that space-time region. And that has a volume of three, and I've got three elements in here. So I've got a number-to-volume correspondence, but I know that there isn't continuous symmetry underlying this, which is Lorentz symmetry. And if I undergo a boost, then I've emptied out that region of any point. So I can't satisfy the number-to-volume correspondence in a regular lattice. And that number-to-volume correspondence was very important in me recovering continuum geometry. Okay? As a result of this, you have to come up with a different kind of discretization, and the idea is to then use a random lattice, which is generated via Poisson process. This is a very important step in the causal set approach, and this, I think, also distinguishes it from several of the other ideas that were proposed earlier, except perhaps Mirheim, who also had this idea of using a Poisson process. And that is that if you use a Poisson process where the volume element here is a space-time volume, then you get on an average that the number of elements in any given region is proportional to the volume. Here, of course, it depends on the density of sprinkling, but that's true even for a regular lattice. You'd have to worry about what the discretization scale is. So what happens here is that you recover it on an average, and this kind of Poisson, this kind of random lattice is what you work with. So you can ask the question, does this resolve Riemann's dilemma? And the answer to this is yes. And I'm just going to go very quickly over an argument. Are there any questions so far? The important, yeah.
This is something I don't understand still from the last talk. So this is all random sprinkling, but then can't I just boost it enough so that there's now an empty space over here and then there's volume is zero?
Right, so if you think of a finite region, yes, of course, all of it will squash up into some region here. But if you think of it over all of Minkowski space and you did a boost, then the idea is that so here's the answer to Riemann's dilemma. So I'll just give you a formal answer to this, and then...
What was his dilemma exactly?
The dilemma was how do you get precisely this, under Lorentz invariance, how does... discreteness and Lorentz invariance, for example. For him, of course, rotational symmetry. But here, Lorentz invariance.
Sorry, what is U in the diagram?
Pardon?
You have U and V.
This is just, I've just plotted it in two dimensions in the light cone coordinates. Yeah? It's just the light cone coordinates, U and V. It's just a two-dimensional causal set. Okay, so let me just say that there's a very nice proof of Lorentz invariance, and it has to do with the fact that the Lorentz group is fundamentally non-compact, and this will take me just a few seconds to say a few words. It's kind of technical, but this proof is due to Bombelli, Henson, and Sorkin, and that is that if you tried on a given sprinkling, you said, let me pick a direction, okay? Let me try to pick a direction in a given sprinkling and say, well, I'm going to mark that direction. Then because what I have is a Poisson sprinkling, this Poisson sprinkling is actually invariant. The set is, if I look at the space of all sprinklings into Minkowski space-time, the measure that I get on the space is volume preserving and Lorentz invariant. It has to be because of the fact that what I've got, you know, the way that I defined the Poisson sprinkling was via a volume. The space-time volume is invariant under Lorentz transformation, right? Lengths are not, time is not, but space-time volume is invariant, right? And that's the key, that there is this invariant volume invariance there in the sprinkling process, in the sprinkling, and this basically gives rise to this theorem, which is that there's no measurable map which picks a direction. And it's coming from the fact that if you did, then you'd have a measure on this non-compact space of directions that you have in Minkowski spacetime. In Minkowski spacetime, the set of unit directions forms a hyperboloid, which is non-compact, as opposed to Euclidean space, where the set of unit directions is compact. And that non-compactness is what gives rise to the fact that you can't, in fact, pick a direction. Okay? I've gone by this very quickly, but we can come back to this later. So let me just go back then to what we mean by the causal set formulation. We start off with replacing space-time by locally finite partially ordered sets. And by that, what I mean is that instead of a path integral where I'm possibly summing over manifolds and so on, a path integral for continuous manifolds, I replace that with a path integral or a path sum over these discrete objects, where the measure now is going to be given by my discrete Einstein-Hilbert action. That's one way of thinking of it. This is perhaps an easy way of thinking of what this approach is all about. We're getting rid of the continuum. We're replacing it entirely by these locally finite partially ordered sets. If I look at the space of causal sets, and I've this orange region here is supposed to be the space of all possible causal sets, then the space of things that are manifold-like, in other words, things that come from the kind of sprinkling, the Poisson sprinkling that I talked about, is a very, very tiny space. Okay? And here I've put in an equivalence relation because I don't want to distinguish between manifolds that are different in the small, because the causal set has a discreteness scale which cannot distinguish between manifolds which are very similar to each other. So the, inside the space of causal sets, you have this little space, little region of manifold-like objects. And if you picked a causal set at random, the typical causal set will look something like this. It's what's called a Kleitman-Rothschild causal set. And it looks nothing like a manifold. It has just three moments of time. And it looks like a very dangerous-looking object. It grows very rapidly. The typical causal set with n grows super exponentially. So there's many, many more of them, the larger the number of causal sets you have. Yeah.
Can you say something about the measure of gravity with respect to the sum over the partially ordered sets?
Right. So when we make that, so I will say a few words when I describe the dynamics. This is just as a sketch to sort of say what is it that we're trying to do. And of course, the devil is in the details. This is just a very broad sketch, and one has to worry about such issues, of course. So one of the biggest challenges, if you look at this, you know, having thrown away the space-times, is that most of the causal sets look nothing like space-time, and to recover anything like space-time looks like a lot of work for the dynamics to do.
So are you using manifold-like interchangeably with the causal sets that you can obtain by Poisson sprinkling?
Yes, absolutely.
But in principle, it's not just Minkowski space you're sprinkling into.
Yes, so I just showed examples of Minkowski space-time, but you can... So let me just reiterate, because perhaps this is not clear, is that for any given space-time manifold, you can extract out an ensemble of causal sets corresponding to this Poisson sprinkling. And that Poisson sprinkling has to do just with the volume, which is the space-time volume, which is there for any curve space-time that you can think of. You can define it, right? So it's equally well-defined for curve space-time as any other space, as flat space-time. So this ensemble of causal sets is what we think of as manifold-like causal sets. And that's what comes with a certain measure coming from the Poisson sprinkling. But that's what I mean by these manifold-like causal sets. And the important ingredient here is that the continuum can only arise as an approximation, not as a limit. OK, so I think that I've sort of given you a brief overview of what we're trying to do. And of course, now, like I said, the devil is in the details. And an important question that we want to be able to ask is, how do we reconstruct geometry? Where is space-time hidden in the order? Many causal sets are not space-time-like, not manifold-like. But for the ones that are, if my dynamics was to throw up a class of causal sets, can I just look at it and say, well, there are certain features of this which make it manifold-like? It's the ability to be able to recognize what is manifold-like in a given causal set. Because that's the kind of thing that'll be interesting to me from the point of view of physics. And the question that you want to ask, and this is what I would call the geometric reconstruction program, which in itself is, I think, a mathematically interesting and very rich subject. Because what we're asking is, just give me an order theoretic object. Can I extract geometry from this? All I have is order relations. Can I extract geometry? And just to put this in perspective, let me compare with other kinds of discretizations that one might want to do. One does in quantum gravity and in other approaches, other areas of physics. And one is the one that is used, for example, in CDTs is a simplicial decomposition of space-time. You begin by taking a d-dimensional space-time, looking at a d-dimensional simplicial decomposition of the space-time. And so what you get when you do such a triangulation are fixed valency dual graphs, where by dual graph, I mean go to the inside of one of these tetrahedra, and you look at the nearest neighbors. Okay. This valency of this is fixed, it's dimension dependent. And so in these structures, these kinds of discretizations, dimension and topology are very easy to extract. They almost come, you know, there's a whole technology that is there and you can just simply use it. The geometry is a little harder, and in fact, the Regi action is one way of constructing an action for these. But importantly, with all of these discretization schemes, you can construct graphs which are fixed, finite valency graphs, and they have a basic property of being local. Okay, there's a sense that this discretization is local. When you look at causal sets, you realize that the causal set need not be a fixed valency graph. And that's because if I think of the nearest neighbors of a point like this, I think of the entire, if I think of the hyperboloid of unit hyperboloid that's to the future of this point here, then that, like I said, is a non-compact, it's a non-compact space. But it means that the number of nearest neighbors that you have can be infinite in Minkowski spacetime. Because you can have a link, a fundamental relation between two elements, which is irreducible, that goes all the way up a light cone. Okay? So there's something fundamentally non-local about discretizing and keeping Lorentz invariants. You can't get rid of non-locality. And I mean non-locality in the sense of, I mean it interchangeably with the idea that the valency of the graph that you produce is not fixed nor finite, not necessarily finite. Okay. So this is gives you a very different beast to handle. Geometric reconstruction becomes a huge challenge because of non-locality.
Is the expectation value infinite if you consider one of your sprinklings?
Yeah, so this is something you obtain from a sprinkling, and the expectation value will blow up. in Minkowski spacetime. So let me just briefly then go over what the kinds of things that one has been actually been able to achieve in this geometric reconstruction program. You know, basically you're looking at this Poisson distribution, you're looking at this causal set that's been obtained via sprinkling, and you're going to ask, where's the geometry and topology hidden here? And there are many of these that we've been able to find. One is the space-time dimension. The earliest was the space-time dimension, which Mirham himself had found. And I'm just writing it down here because it's a very simple estimator. It's a dimensional estimator for flat space-time. So d, little d is the dimension of the space-time. Capital N are the number of elements that you've done the sprinkling with. And R is the number of relations, so just the number of pairs which are related to each other. So all you do is you count this number of relations, and you have the number of, you know, space-time events, and you find the dimension just by this very simple relation. Okay? There are other estimators. One is called the midpoint estimator. Then there are others that we've recently found. All of them suggest that the order is enough to get out continuum space-time dimension. Okay. The other very interesting thing is how to construct topology from the order theoretic structure. And we have been fairly successful in obtaining the spatial homology, which you basically need to start with something that looks like a spatial hypersurface. And you look at the induced structures on it from the rest of the space-time, and you get out a very beautiful construction that gives you the spatial homology. Another very, all of this is, the spatial homology calculation is fairly involved, but the time-like distance, which Brightwell and Gregory found very early on, is very easy to understand. And it's basically just saying, well, if I have the causal structure and I have, you know, I think of time-like distance. Time-like distance is obtained by maximizing a path, right, between two points. The maximal route gives you the time-like distance. And it's the same idea here. You look at the length of the maximal chain that you have, maximal number of points that could be intervening between these two points. Okay? So the same ideas of Lorentzian geometry are repeated, and you have something like a time-like distance. We have other kinds of distance also that you can construct. Importantly, there is a very important set of geometric invariants was constructed, starting with the D'Alembertian, the scalar curvature, and finally with the action. And this is quite an interesting, I think that if you were to ask, well, where is the action hidden in the causal set, it's a very non-obvious kind of answer, but at the end of the day, what it gives you is something very beautiful. You're basically, again, just counting objects, but what are the objects you're counting? So let me just give you go over this briefly. So if I have a point here, and I look at its nearest neighbors, they're the ones contained in this first layer here. So they're the ones with the irreducible relations between the two points. There's nothing intervening. And then the next layer is such that I have just one element in between. Okay, so this is in the next layer, and it has just one intervening element between. And when I go down to the next layer, then I have two in between and so on. So what I'm counting here are just the intervals, the causal diamonds with a certain volume inside them. If you think of the number of elements intervening corresponding to volume, then I'm just counting how many intervals do you have of zero volume, which means that there's nothing intervening. How many do you have with volume one between them, with just in one intervening point, how many with two, and so on. And the amazing thing is that if you put them all together, then you can construct, and here's a simple example of that in two dimensions, the equivalent of the Einstein-Hilbert action in the causal set, which is just this beautifully simple relation where you're counting the number of links or the number of irreducible relations, the number of ones which have just one element in between, the number that has two. And what you get is something that, in the limit of large n, gives you back the Einstein-Hilbert action. And you've done it purely from order, from purely order theoretics, you know, from just the order structure that you have, you've constructed the curvature invariant, you've constructed the action. And interestingly then, this action that you have recovers locality. What you had initially, when you look at the causal set, it looks very non-local, but this action that you construct is essentially local. It only depends on a small region around a given element. The curvature is local, and therefore the action is local. And this is, in fact, what goes into, you asked what is a measure, how do we construct the action for a causal set? This is the action that goes into the dynamics. We've also got a way to use the counting to construct boundary terms, Gibbon-Hawking boundary terms, and an entirely different set of constructions for the Green's functions for scalar fields. This is sort of a list. It's hard to go into any of these in detail, and I'm happy to answer questions at the end about some of these details. But let me focus on an important aspect of all of this, is that so there is a geometric reconstruction. We get all of this geometric information from the causal structure. But at the end of the day, when we're doing quantum gravity, we want observables in the theory, right? And here's a very simple characterization of observables, which is just that observables are order invariants. You have a partially ordered set, a locally finite partially ordered set. What are the observables of your theory? They're any order invariant that you want. The ones that we've constructed are the ones that are physically interesting because they relate to manifolds. But there's a whole host of ordered invariants that people who do Poisson sets are interested in. They're different kinds of homologies, different kinds of topologies. All of these are ordered invariants, and all of these are observables in the theory. And the important thing is that these observables that you construct are fundamentally space-time and character because they're all built out of the causal structure. They're not tied into a moment of time. They're not tied into any way in which you're dividing space-time into space and time. They're basically built out of the causal structure. So they're fundamentally space-time and character. But one important thing is that causal sets don't admit Cauchy hypersurfaces. You can construct something like a spatial hypersurface because it's just a set of points which are unrelated to each other. They're not related in the partial order. And you can make them maximal. You can look at the largest set possible. You start off with one, and you say, look at a largest set possible, meaning there's no other point that you can add here which is also space-like related to the set. And so you'd imagine that that object, which I've sort of put in red, the set, might look something like a Cauchy hypersurface. But a Cauchy hypersurface has this ability to be the summary of everything that's taken place up to that point, right? It is a summary. And so you'd say, well, is this a summary of everything that has happened up to the past? And the fact is that no, because you can always find elements like this which can somehow communicate to each other, bypassing this set completely. So Cauchy hypersurfaces, writing things down as space and time, is not at all natural in a causal set. In the continuum, one would imagine that by thickening this substantially, you'd get something that approximates a Cauchy hypersurface, because that's obviously what we see in, I mean, we know that things are predictable in GR. We'd like to have that we'd like to recover that, but at the fundamental level, at the discreteness scale, there is no natural way of describing things into space and time. So the next fork in the road that we take is the path integral, where we look at the entire causal set as a single history, and we look at trying to describe. So in the last few minutes, I'll just describe a little bit about causal set dynamics, which sort of will complete the story so far. There is an approach called the sequential growth dynamics approach, which was carried out by Rideout and Sorkin. And they constructed a classical sequential growth dynamics. And the idea is very, very beautiful and very simple, and that is that causal sets are grown element by element and in a sequential way. So if we think of things like the initial conditions for the universe and so on, they're very simple to think of in the causal set picture, because if I think of elements being created over time, elements coming into existence, then the simplest initial condition you can have is that there was one element, right? You have to have the first element before you get the second element and so on. It's a very simple, but that's it. And you can think of, if you, for example, wanted something coming out of a single event, then the single event would be to the past of all other future events. And that's your initial condition. Again, that happens with probability one. So in a sense, it's very easy within this discrete model to answer some of the puzzles of quantum gravity, or to be able to frame the puzzles of quantum gravity. I shouldn't say answer. And the observables or the beables that we have then correspond to properties of causal sets in an event algebra. And this is the structure of how we think of these sequential growth dynamics. But it is a challenge to formulate a quantum dynamics, and this is something that people have been thinking about. We have a very small, very simple toy model we've been working on. But the other approach, so apart from the sequential growth model, we have another class of approaches which I'll call the path sum approaches. And here we basically write down a partition function, and we look at this action, which is the Benincasa-Dauker action, which is the analog of the Einstein-Hilbert action. We try to calculate things for this partition function. Very recently, there's been work by Carlip and Loomis where they've examined this, and they find that some of the causal sets, which are these non-manifold-like causal sets, which are bilayer posets, in fact, if you calculate the partition function just restricted to those, then they're actually quite suppressed in this part sum, which is good news because it tells you that that these very entropically dominant causal sets, so there's a possibility that they may not be that important in the dynamics. We've also been working on looking at just this part sum by looking at an analytic continuation of the measure to this thing that looks like a statistical partition function. And we've done quite a lot of work in the two-dimensional case, and we find some interesting properties that arise in 2D. I want to say that all of these approaches, these ideas here are in some sense things that we're trying to do given the action. Of course, the idea is that if we think of the sequential growth dynamics and if we had a way of formulating the quantum dynamics from a first principles way, in which is what happened in the classical sequential growth dynamics, if there was a way to do that in the quantum case, then that would give us a more compelling way to construct the dynamics for causal sets. And the challenge, of course, is that in any of these dynamics, you want to get out manifold likeness. In the special models that we did, looked at in the two-dimensional case, there is manifold likeness that is emergent, and in fact, you get something like a cosmological constant that also comes out of it. So as in any theory of quantum gravity, I think it's very hard to sort of say that we've actually made significant progress in any one direction. This is all work in progress, and there's a lot to say, and I think I've only sort of given a very brief little summary of all the things that one is trying to do. And there are several directions, future directions to take. One is to extend this path some to higher dimensions, take the geometric reconstruction program further. There are also a host of very interesting questions on quantum field theory and causal sets, trying to construct the quantum sequential growth dynamics, and of course, the phenomenology. So I'll stop here and questions.
Are there any questions from the students in the audience?
See your set of all the capital omega. What is that, and how do you change the dimension?
Right, so that's a really good question. In the picture that I drew, this one with a set of causal sets and the manifolds, the causal set approach is really ambitious. In the set of manifolds, we have made no restriction to dimension. There could be any dimensional causal set you like in there, any dimensional manifold you like in there. Okay, so we haven't. So when you write down omega without any restrictions, you're looking at all possible causal sets where you've made no dimensional restriction at all. So that's so when you write it down, that's one option that you have, is to look at the sample space of all possible causal sets. What we did in the two-dimensional case was to say, well, maybe that's a bit too big to chew. Let's look at the simplest case possible, which is two dimensions, and that's what we've done. And we sort of use it as a toy example. I mean, it's a full-fledged model of quantum gravity. But we've restricted this to two dimensions, where the dimensions are defined not just from the continuum perspective, but order theoretically. So we're not only looking at two-dimensional spacetimes, we're also looking at causal sets which have a particular two-ordered theoretic dimension. Okay? So that restriction, so now you can ask, well, there should be other restrictions which are natural, and one restriction which is natural is just restricting the number of elements in the causal set. So look at finite element causal sets and look at that sample space. You could look at that, or you could say, well, I want to look at, in the sequential growth, the thing that's natural to look at are things that are past finite causal sets, but they're countable. So they're infinite, but they're past finite. So you're putting in some constraints. So it depends on what exactly you want to do. And in different models, in different cases, we've used different kinds of sample spaces.
Suppose you were interested.
We start with the students and then move on. We have a couple more student questions.
So, what if you were just interested in using this as a probe for the conformal structure of Lorentzian manifolds? So, for example, when looking at asymptotics, that seems to be the most relevant information. So, I mean, are there some thoughts in this direction? In that case, is discreteness inevitable, or is there?
Well, I think you're asking, for example, you know, the way in which we can think of ideal points in a space-time. So this is sort of Garrosh and Penrose and Kronheimer did a lot of work on this in subsequent paper of that came out after this paper on causal spaces, which is to basically look at sequences of causal relations and look at ideal points. Now, all of those constructions seem to need, you know, they don't have local finiteness.
Right.
And so question of how do you construct, how do you sort of, how do you codify such ideal points in a causal set is rather tricky, partly because we don't have, you know, what does it mean to have a limiting element, but also, okay, so the answer to that is yes, these are interesting questions that have occurred to us over, you know, over the last few years, but I think to actually pinpoint how to formulate such a thing in a causal set is not, but maybe Rafael has some ideas.
Something came to mind in answer to your question, some work that Nosipi Lozwane did, who was a student here who just graduated. It's related to ADS-CFT. In a certain well-defined sense, if you start with ADS, produce a causal set by sprinkling, and take the limit in which the sprinkling density goes to zero, it goes over to the boundary of ADS.
Okay, I see.
The causal, in the causal sense.
I see.
It reproduces the causal structure of the boundary. So maybe that
is
something along.
But that has, yes. So that has to do with the fact that the volume is basically all focused on the...
Yeah, it's... Right.
It is related to the sprinkling and how the volume really lives on the boundary, so to speak. But in flat and asymptotically flat spacetime, I mean, one has thought about this question, but I think it's a fairly tricky to formulate. Yeah.
Any more student questions?
Discrete has given a sense of quantization, but how would you formulate other aspects of quantum spacetime, such as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in this? I mean, is there a natural way to have uncertainty, a finite volume in the phase space?
So, I mean, this, of course, like I said, we're not... So to think in terms of phase space is perhaps a bit is misleading in this context, because you really should be thinking in terms of the path integral only, and in the specific sense that, you know, the history space. But of course, all of the uncertainty comes about in the measure that you choose. It's all encoded in the quantum measure, the fact that you have quantum interference. And all of that comes into how you define the measure. So explicitly asking whether a Heisenberg uncertainty principle will come out in a phase space language, it's not natural here. But insofar as the continuum will pop out of this, should pop out of this, and we have a prescription for how it will, then all of those structures, the same sort of thing that you see in quantum mechanics, will still be true. But to think of the position momentum way of thinking about it, which is really a Hamiltonian prescription, as more fundamental, giving you fundamental information about the quantization of space-time, is, I think, not the way to proceed for causal sets, where you instead want to think of the path integral. You want to think in terms of the quantum measure and how that encodes interference and the coherence of quantum paths. That's language in which one should be thinking about this.
Just make an addition.
We're going to open it up. Why don't you start?
Can I just...
Oh, you had a comment on the last one? Yeah, sure.
Not strictly adding anything to what somebody said, but again, something that came to mind that's closely related to your question, which is there's a further uncertainty that has to do with fluctuations in volume having to do with Poisson fluctuations. And it's that combined with a Heisenberg principle relating cosmological constant to space-time volume that led to the prediction of the non-zero cosmological constant. So there is some interesting connection. Heisenberg-like thing, plus the real Heisenberg thing that led to an interesting, you know, the interesting part of the story.
I just wanted to ask something very simple. Suppose you are interested in something like just flat spacetime, physics in flat spacetime, or some other curved spacetime. It's simple, you know. Where in the formalism would you put such an input so that
you would be able to restrict yourself to
absolutely
certain questions.
So I would say that it's exactly in the, so one set of questions you might want to ask is purely to do with classical space-time, right? So it's, you give a fixed space-time, and you say, well, what is the causal ensemble of causal sets corresponding to that fixed space-time? Then you extract those causal sets, that ensemble, via Poisson sprinkling. So those are the causal sets. So you would restrict this. So I could restrict this to a space which is just obtained via Poisson sprinkling.
So you say...
And I could do...
Just say flat.
Yeah, I could do that for flat space-time or with any curved space-time. Give me a space-time and
find a sprinkling which is different than some other space-time.
Yes, that's right. So this ensemble is distinct, and here again I didn't mention a very important conjecture in the theory which a lot of the geometric reconstruction somehow supports, which is that for two manifolds that are sufficiently different, the ensemble of causal sets will be different. So the causal sets cannot really correspond to two distinctly different manifolds, space-times.
In your last slide, you had quantum field theory on causal sets.
Mm-hmm.
What's the idea there? You don't have Cauchy surfaces. Do you associate Hilbert spaces with the nodes and something like some sort of gates, discrete gates between them?
So there's been a lot of work done, in fact, in PI and also earlier by Stephen Johnston on trying to write down scalar fields on a causal set. And the starting point for that has been to go via writing down a Green function, so the advanced and retarded Green function, and using that and the Pyle's bracket prescription, which is a space-time prescription for writing down, you know, operators for writing down a bracket, to define this thing called a Pauli-Jordan function or operator. And that gives you then the Feynman-Green function and so on. You can construct quantum field theory in that way. And along the way, so I'm only giving you a part of the story, but what you can do in this way is also construct a vacuum, and this is called the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum, which is purely based on sort of a space-time, based just on the advanced and retarded Green function, which is something you can do in a causal set because it's just dependent on the causal structure. We have difficulty doing things, like you said, in a, you know, space-time 3+1 dimensional split. So you need to actually, when you're doing quantum fields, you can't simply borrow the technology from elsewhere. Stephen had to put together all these ideas and come up with this notion of what a vacuum would look like, use the Pyle's bracket prescription. And there's been a lot of work on this that Raphael and the students have done. Importantly, there's this whole entanglement entropy construction that Yasaman and Raphael worked on in causal sets, which again has a lot of intriguing, puzzling features to it, which need to be understood better.
So in classical gravity, we're often interested in space-times that are like nicely causally behaved in some region that we access, and then which fail to be so when we cross through, so like the Kerr space-time, for example. And if I was following correctly, because the Kerr time machine has closed causal curves, you wouldn't be able to do this there because it wouldn't have a poset.
Right, so you wouldn't have posets, so it comes under the hierarchy, would come under the class of those acausal regions of space-time. You don't have a poset for that.
So what happened instead? Because it seems like we're allowed to make space-times like that, and then something would have to, you'd have to diverge, I guess, from Einstein somehow when you cross the horizon, right, like there.
So why do you say it would have to diverge? I'm not sure.
Because you wouldn't have made a causal structure in the sense that you needed to make the posets, right?
Right, so the question, are you asking, suppose you had a horizon beyond which you have closed up
space-time, which are only partially causally well-behaved. Like you would need
right.
an extension of some kind.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to describe something which had closed-time-like curves in it, so you'd only describe a part of that. So here you have to ask the question, well, in the hierarchy of spacetimes, if I look at things that are acausal, they don't have a coset structure, then a causal set can't describe something like that. And it's true that Einstein theory allows you all kinds of, like the Gödel spacetime is one which has closed time-like curves in it. It allows you things like that because there are, it's a local field equation. It doesn't impose global conditions. And it allows these globally weird spacetimes. And I think that you have to ask, well, how physical are such spacetimes? And I think the attitude would be that spacetimes that are not causal are not physical. So causality is an important principle in this approach.
I mean, we're often interested in spacetimes which are, like, whose maximal extensions, like, don't, I'm not suggesting that I believe in closed time like curves, but, like, it seems like Einstein gravity would lead you to, like, something would have to change in order to make them fail, right? Like, they're...
Well, you're saying that in terms of they're perfectly normal, good solutions, and...
Vacuum, and then you know if you write down the field equations and you solve this 3+1 that there's going to be something bad happening in the interior. So yeah, that has to be wrong, but it seems like you couldn't do the sprinkling.
Yes, you couldn't do the sprinkling, that's right. So you ask, so I guess your question is, would quantum gravity somehow resolve this?
Yeah, would causal sets give you, like, what would, I guess I'm asking what black hole interiors look like, which is a little ambitious, I understand.
No, but in a black hole, for a Schwarzschild black hole, I mean, as long as there's no closed time-like curves, you're fine. I mean, a Schwarzschild black hole interior should be perfectly fine to describe. In fact, you know, you would hope that the singularity would be resolved, there'd be some other kind of, you know, detailed causal structure, which, you know, causal set, which doesn't look like a manifold as you approach the singularity. So there's no fundamental problem with black hole horizons or any of that. It's just that when you come to, I forget what they call these horizons which separate time-like, closed time-like places where causality is violated and regions where it's not, you wouldn't be able to describe that full space-time, that extended space-time. I don't know if Raphael wants to say.
No, I would say the same thing. Just to add, I don't think anyone believes that realistic astrophysical black holes, which occur to a good approximation, have closed time-like curves inside of them.
Well,
you certainly would not get such a thing by starting with the Einstein equations and following the collapse like people do.
The rate of matter, no, presumably.
Sorry?
The rate of matter, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, but
it's called dark matter. Called dark matter.
Oh, sorry.
People who call dark matter as something fundamentally different.
No.
Oh, you said with cold. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, if you like, I could say it's one of the confirmed predictions so far. Causal set theory is that we shouldn't find closed time-like curves.
I was a little confused about when you were talking about the Cauchy hypersurfaces. I mean, it seems to me that if you have some surface that does not determine the dynamics of the space-time, well, that's just not a Cauchy hypersurface. So, I mean, I guess I kind of missed out why. I mean, if you have
so let me just bring up, if I can, I'll bring up that diagram, that slide again. Oops, sorry. Yeah. So if you think of a Cauchy hypersurface as basically, you know, which it is, but the definition of Cauchy hypersurface is it's a summary of the past. In other words, I should be able to determine the future of the space-time completely from data on this. And that's what makes the system globally hyperbolic and so on. Now, if I were to do that, then that if I were to do that in a causal set, then I should have literally all the information in that, all the data, if you like, in that Cauchy hypersurface. And what I've drawn for you, it looks like those elements are all space-like to each other. And it looks like, okay, everything is either to their past or to their future. So that looks like a really good example of something that looks like a Cauchy hypersurface. But what I've drawn here is a link. So because the causal set is not simply these points which are embedded, there's causal relations between them, right? And if the causal relation here doesn't pass through, it has no intervening element in this Cauchy hypersurface, that means that I've quote unquote, pass the signal from this event to that event without this guy here knowing anything about it.
Okay. Well, I guess my question wouldn't that just, that set then, or that ordering just correspond to some non-globally hyperbolic geometry?
No, but that's the interesting thing, that I've just taken Minkowski spacetime, and this is really globally hyperbolic geometry, and the discretization gives you things that, if I were to naively pick a set like this, that set would not correspond to a Cauchy hypersurface. What will approximately correspond to it is if I actually thickened it, if I had a high sprinkling, you know, if I had a lot of points, a large density of points, and I thickened it in an appropriate way, then such links, although they're possible, will correspond to very, very boosted signals, things that won't matter. So in some sense, they won't affect known physics. But this is something that is, I think, a very interesting property of these discrete structures, of causal sets, which is that things that look like you should be able to do them very easily in the continuum, you can't do them that easily here. But yeah, that's basically what I mean by there being no Cauchy hypersurface. So at least from a fundamental point of view, I can't just put data here and expect to recover everything from there. And in fact, these are the sort of quandaries that we have when we look at quantum fields on causal sets. Trying to define a dynamics that is predictive in a meaningful way is actually not that trivial at all. And it's a big challenge.
One last question. So you said that to maintain the number to volume correspondence, you use this Poisson sprinkling.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a theorem that that's the unique way of sprinkling? Or is it just like one way that works?
It's one way that works, and I think maybe Raphael knows more about this, but there's sort of this conviction that it is perhaps the only one. There may be a few others that work in two dimensions. There are others that work in two dimensions, because two dimensions are special in too many ways. But there's reason to think, yeah, so I don't know. There's a certain, maybe Raphael wants to comment on it, but as far as I'm concerned, from my point of view, it works beautifully, and it gives us very interesting results as far as geometric reconstruction are concerned. So I would, in fact, say it is part of the hypothesis of causal set theory, and I would just work with that. And that's been my attitude to it, is that it gives you so much of geometry because of the use of the volume element.
If you want me to add something, I mean, there are a couple of conjectures that say that no other method of sprinkling does better than Poisson in realizing the approximate equality between volume and number. It's not proven. There are some partial proofs, but it's not proven. There's another conjecture specific to Minkowski space that says the only sprinkling process, point process as it's called in mathematics, which is fully Poincaré invariant, is Poisson. On the other hand, there might be reasons to wish for something that's a little bit different from Poisson sprinkling, having to do with CP violation. If space-time has fundamental orientation, which at the level that we understand the standard model, it does, then you might ask, in the same way that we have a right and left asymmetry, most people, you might ask, is there something deep in our structure that accounts for that? And the answer seems to be yes, it's the way that the DNA spirals or, you know, twists. You might ask, is there something in space-time, whatever is the deep structure of space-time, that accounts for the orientation that it acquires? It could be that the causal set has something like the helix of a DNA, something that distinguishes right from left. That would require a somewhat loosened, more generalized definition of sprinkling, because the Poisson sprinkling will not distinguish between right and left.
So there are good reasons to look for something like that, right?
Sorry?
So there are good reasons to look for...
So there's a very intriguing physical reason why you might want something a little bit different. but at a coarse grain level, would presumably go back to Poisson, just as we don't see the DNA helicity, when you go up to the level of
tissue.
Well, it's true. So that's true. Exactly. Yeah. So you do see it has. It still has its effect in a subtle way. But our effective series of tissues and so on don't have this anymore. This right-left asymmetry.
So, if there are further questions for Samadhi, there's snacks in the bistro. And so that was an extremely clear review of the field. Thank you very much. Let's thank Samadhi again.